Then Moses answered, "But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, 'The Lord did not appear to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He said, "A staff." And he said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Put out your hand and catch it by the tail." So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, that they may believe that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Again, the Lord said to him, "Put your hand inside your cloak." And he put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, like snow. Then God said, "Put your hand back inside your cloak." So he put his hand back inside his cloak. And when he took it out, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. "If they will not believe you," God said, "or listen to the first sign, they may believe the latter sign. If they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And the water that you take from the Nile shall become blood on the dry ground." But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you've spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and of tongue." Then the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and will teach you what you shall speak." But he said, "Oh, my Lord, please send someone else." Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, "Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and will teach you both what to do. He will speak to you, he will speak for you to the people, and he shall be your mouth, and you shall be as God to him. And take in your hand this staff, with which you shall do the signs." A couple of weeks ago, the largest contract in sports history was signed. Mike Trout, the center fielder for the Los Angeles Angels, signed a $426.5 million contract extension. That's almost as much as your college tuition. Mike Trout is earning so much money that if his contract were a country, Mike Trout would rank number 182 on the global list, just ahead of Micronesia. What in the world would inspire a baseball team to pay one guy this much money? After all, for $35 million a year, this team could hire four good baseball players. Why stock all your money in one guy who could get injured, or who could underperform? Well, baseball executives across the sport agree. There's one reason that you would give Mike Trout that much money. The reason is that he is the man you build your team around. Mike Trout can run, he can hit, he can field, he can throw, he's young, and only 7 years in the major leagues. Mike Trout has been voted most valuable player twice, second most valuable player four times, and the other year he came in fourth, but he was hurt for almost half the year. He's one of the best players the sport has ever seen. If you had to build your team around one guy, it would be Mike Trout. If you could build your team around one person, who would it be? Maybe it's a fantasy baseball or fantasy football league. Maybe it's a real team. Maybe you've been a high school coach and you could think of the one player you would like to be at the center of your best team. Maybe it's not coaching, but you've been a teacher, and you could think of the one student you would like to have at the center of your classroom. Maybe you haven't worked with students. As a current youth director, I do not fault you. I just came out of our youth lock-in yesterday morning, and I'm still recovering. We'll blame any verbal miscues on that. But maybe you've worked in some other capacity, and you could imagine if you had one huge project, who you would like to be at the center of that team. We'd pick the best, the most capable, the most reliable, the most likable. That's who we'd want at the center of our team. Now, imagine that you are the God of the universe. It's a thought experiment, you're not, but just imagine with me that you are. And imagine that you have the biggest mission imaginable. You need one person to lead your people out of slavery in Egypt. Who would you pick? Maybe a strapping, young, good-looking, 30-year-old, inspirational man who can lead them out of Egypt with confidence and style? Or how about an 80-year-old, ex-murdering shepherd? Can you believe God picked option B? We're often so familiar with the story of Moses that we forget when Moses was called, he was no Mike Trout. On the one hand, that story should inspire us because it means that if God can call Moses to do great things, then he could call you or me to do great things. But on the other hand, maybe that story should inspire fear in us, because if God can call Moses to do great things, what's keeping him from calling you or me to do great things? Perhaps you've been sensing that call in some way lately. Maybe the call to step up on a serve team here at Cornerstone. Perhaps the call to share your faith with a neighbor down the street. The call to reconcile with a family member. And in hearing God's call, perhaps you have been hesitant, saying, "Me? I'm nothing special. How could I do that?" Or perhaps in hearing God's call, you've kept it at an arm's length, saying, "Me? Why would I want to do that? I'd rather stay where I'm comfortable." My hope is that in hearing the story of Moses this morning, we will see that God does call, that he calls each one of us to do great things, and that when God calls and we yield, he works. God calls, we yield, he works. When Moses received his call, he was not expecting it. He was pastoring his flock, probably on a normal Tuesday afternoon, when all of a sudden, he sees a bush that's on fire but not burning up. Goes over to check it out, and that's where God tells him he is going to lead the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. It's like you take a lunch break from work and God tells you you're going to be the next president of the United States. An everyday normal activity, where did this huge call come from? 400 years. That's how long they've been in slavery. 400 years. That's even longer than the last time the Patriots won the Super Bowl. 400 years is a long time. And Moses, he's not the guy for the job. After all, Moses was born as a Hebrew, but he was raised as an Egyptian. Those of you who know the story know that Moses' mother hid Moses as a baby because Pharaoh was murdering all of the Hebrew boys to keep their population from dwarfing that of the Egyptians. And Pharaoh's daughter found Moses by the water and raised him as a member of Pharaoh's household. But Moses retained his Hebrew roots. It's the same way that many people infiltrate Boston on St. Patrick's Day. His roots stayed, though he had been transplanted, and when he saw an Egyptian man mistreating a Hebrew, he murdered the Egyptian. Which doesn't typically get you in Pharaoh's good graces. Moses is forced to flee. He enters exile and expects that he'll retire and enter a nice, calm life as a shepherd, hopefully never returning to the land where he was a convict. That's the guy God calls an 80-year-old man who's a murderer and a shepherd? He's not the guy for the job. Or is he? Doesn't God make a habit of calling very ordinary people to extraordinary things? After all, who was the man to slay the Philistine giant Goliath? It was a shepherd boy, the youngest of seven sons, David. Who was the man that wrote the majority of the New Testament? It was a former Pharisee who watched with approval the murder of the first Christian martyr, Paul. Who were the two men that were called in Acts, the men who turned the world upside down because their faith and their belief in Jesus Christ was transforming the world? It was two uneducated fishermen, Peter and John. My seminary president recently told a fable in his sermon, which I thought captured the idea well. His story went that Jesus ascended to heaven after rising from the dead, where he was met by the angel Gabriel, who greeted him saying, "Well, did you do it?" And Jesus said, "Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I went to earth, I preached, I healed, I died for the sins of man, and I rose from the dead and came back here." Gabriel said, "Well, what about the mission? You know, for all the lost people on earth to come to know your name, weren't you going to tell them all? Aren't you going to tell everybody?" And Jesus said, "Oh, yeah, of course. I left that in the hands of my disciples." Gabriel says, "Your disciples? That ragtag bunch of fishermen and tax collectors that fled from you the night you got arrested, you left it up to them? What if they fail? What's your backup plan?" Jesus says, "Well, there is no backup plan." Jesus called a very normal, unqualified group of people to change the world. But the call didn't end with them. On your bulletin is a mission statement of Cornerstone Church. A part of it's taken from Matthew chapter 28, verses 18 to 19, which is on the screen behind me, where Jesus comes and says and gives his disciples this commandment: "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations." Make disciples is the only command that shows up in this verse. In Greek, that's the command: go make disciples. But subservient to that command is that they are supposed to baptize and teach these people to do everything Jesus commanded them. What did Jesus just command his disciples? To make more disciples. What are the disciples supposed to do? Obey everything Jesus commanded them. Ergo, by the transitive property of equality, if you were a math teacher once, if not, just pretend I didn't say those words. A disciple makes disciples. By definition, every Christian also makes more disciples. That means sharing our faith with those who don't know. That means teaching and training and equipping those who do. That's a big call. We're not qualified for it. We're broken people. We don't know all there is to know. And if the call to share our faith and the call to train others intimidates us, perhaps it should. But it is what we're called to do. God calls unqualified people for incredible things. And if that is the call, then the next question is, what is our response? And perhaps we'll see in Moses' response to God's call a few common threads as to how we might want to respond to God's call. Because Moses has a very good list of reasons why he is not the type of person for this call. We skipped over chapter 3, but in it, Moses already delivered a couple pretty good jabs. Who am I? And God, who are you? And in chapter 4, we see three more brilliant excuses Moses comes up with. What about them? What are they going to say? I'm not good enough. I can't speak well. And when all of those are bulldozed, the old faithful, God, just send somebody else. Maybe some of those reasons resonate with us. Who am I? I'm not good enough. What'll they say? Just send someone else. It's interesting that God doesn't respond to Moses by saying, but Moses, you can do it. I believe in you. You're capable. Look how good of a man you are. You're strong. You're powerful. You can speak. No, instead he responds by asking Moses a very simple question. What is in your hand? I mean, Moses looks and thought you were omniscient, God. I thought you could tell, but whatever. It's just a staff. A staff's nothing special. Everybody in the ancient Near East has got a staff. It's like a wallet, like a driver's license. It's a really basic possession. When the patriarch Jacob talked of how God had blessed him, he said that he started out with just the staff in his hand. It's like our phrase today, just the clothes on my back. It's a very simple everyday possession. But to Moses, it was a little bit more than that. A staff was the way a shepherd made his living. With his staff, Moses beat away the wolves. With his staff, Moses guided his sheep. A staff wasn't anything special by appearance. Wasn't any big deal to anybody else. But to Moses, this was something really special. Maybe you know what that feels like, to have a possession that to everybody else doesn't look very special, but to you is very dear. I love to hike. And about 7 years ago or so, I inherited a pair of hiking boots from my dad, which since then, I have hiked every single mountain I've climbed. About 40 mountains, probably 300, 400 miles I've put on these boots. There are holes in the side of them. When you hike, you go through mud, you go through water, you go through snow. None of those are good for holes. My boots don't really do a good job anymore. But they mean more to me than just a pair of boots. In those boots, I've hiked mountains all over the country. They're special to me. That's a little bit like Moses' staff. It's not just a stick. This is how he's made his living. This is what's been in his hand every single day. And God tells him, Moses, throw it on the ground. Not just put it on the ground, not just place it on the ground, throw it on the ground. Everywhere else in the book of Exodus, when this Hebrew word rendered throw appears, it means throw it and you're not getting it back. Pharaoh threw the babies into the Nile. Moses threw the tablets of the commandment and shattered them on the ground. Aaron threw gold into the fire. When God tells Moses to throw his staff, he's saying, Moses, take this thing that's not very special by what other people see, but is very special to you, and throw it at my feet for me to do with it as I see fit. Does that ring a bell for anyone? It's fascinating to me that God starts with something that's not a big deal, but to Moses is very special. But that theme doesn't stop. There's one word that kept on coming up throughout chapter 4, the word hand. Moses, what's in your hand? Take the staff in your hand. Pick it back up with your hand. Moses picks it back up with his hand. Take your hand, put it inside your cloak. Take your hand back outside of your cloak. Now your hand is not leprous anymore. Hand, hand, hand. It appears over and over and over and over again till the very end of that section when God says, take this staff in your hand. It's as if God is saying to Moses, Moses, you don't need to go get any special seminary training. You don't need to go become any big, important person. You don't need to go become somebody great. I just want you to start with what's in your hand. And isn't that how God tends to work? After all, what was in David's hand? Just a river rock. But with it, he slew a giant. What was in Paul's hand? Blood from a martyr and wisdom of a Pharisee with which he wrote half the New Testament. What was in the hand of Peter and John? Just a story. And with it, they turned the world upside down. A pastor I worked with turned the question on his congregation. What's in your hand? What's in your hand? It might not look like anything special to the rest of the world, but if God has called us, and he has, he's also placed something in our hand. Maybe it's time in retirement. Time where you expect to have a nice and peaceful and restful retirement, but time with which you could reach out to a youth in this congregation and mentor them. Getting together over ice cream once a week and simply sharing in life and investing in them. Did you know that that's actually one of the main reasons that youth stay in the church? Is when people outside their family in a congregation disciple and invest in them? Maybe you're a college student, and to you, with all your studies and all the things going on and how murky the rest of life looks, I mean, you don't even know how to cook ramen. What can I do for God's kingdom? But did you know that it's during the college years that more often than not, people become set in what they're going to believe for the rest of their lifetime? And that the way people are most often brought to church or challenged in their faith or their faith is entrenched is their friends? Even at Gordon College, people lose their faith. I know. I watched one of my best friends lose his faith at Gordon. You can make a difference by being a friend, by challenging others, by asking them how they're doing in their walk, by praying with them, by caring for them. What's in your hand? Maybe it's friendship. Or maybe all that's in your hand is a story. You don't want to teach, you don't want to speak, you're not sure about stepping into leadership, but God took your life from death and brought it to abundance. He took you from a place where you were broken and hurt, and he gave you new life. Maybe what's in your hand is a story that if you were to share with a coworker or neighbor, their life could be changed. What is in your hand? So often we imagine that greatness and leadership can only look like people who are exceptional, who've got something exceptional in their hands. We love the stories of Michael Jordan, cut from the basketball team in high school, but worked hard enough and had that ability to which he became the greatest. Or we love the story of Albert Einstein, who flunked out of math but had that innate ability where he worked hard enough and got recognized for the theory of general relativity. But far more often, God has worked with very ordinary people, with nothing apparently special. Far more often, the biblical pattern of leadership isn't we work harder and become great, but God takes something ordinary and makes it extraordinary. In fact, the biblical pattern of leadership, far more often than not, is of people who didn't want to be leaders. In our current political climate, it's hard to remember a time when we had a leader who didn't want to be a leader. But I love the way the Mount Vernon website, the George Washington's website, not his website, the internet came later, he didn't make, you understand, But a website about George Washington, which cites that at the beginning of America, when rumblings started that George Washington should be the first president, it was much to his dismay. And he gave several great reasons why he wouldn't be a good president. The Federalists wouldn't like him. He was too old. He really liked the idea of a nice retirement. That was in his top five reasons. But what was in his hand? Experience as a general. He laid it down and gave it a shot, and the man is on our dollar bill. What is in your hand? And what could it look like if something not very special in the eyes of the world, but very precious in your eyes, what could it look like if you laid it down, threw it down at God's feet? Because when God does call, and he does, and we yield, he works. For how much Moses' hand shows up in chapter 4, it's pretty bizarre that Moses' hand doesn't reappear for several chapters. Did you know that in chapter 5, when Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, it's not only Aaron who speaks, but it's also Aaron who throws his staff at Pharaoh's feet, and it turns into a snake. It's Aaron who does the first sign. It doesn't go very well. Pharaoh doesn't believe and instead puts more tasks on the Israelites, which is when we arrive at the end of chapter 5, again on the screen, chapter 5, verse 22 to chapter 6, verse 1. Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all. God, I tried." But then God says something beautiful. The Lord said to Moses, "Now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand, he will send them out. With a strong hand, he will drive them out of his land." And later on in chapter 6, God makes clear, "It is by my mighty hand." In other words, Moses, it has nothing to do with the hand. It's not Aaron's hand that's special. It's not Pharaoh's hand that's special. It's not your hands that are special. It's my hand that's moving all those hands. My hand is what will make your hand do something great. My hand is what made Aaron's hand throw down that staff. My hand is what will make Pharaoh's hand drive the people out of Egypt. It has nothing to do with your hands. It is my hand that will deliver the people from Egypt. Moses' hands weren't the instruments. They were the instruments, but it wasn't because his hands were anything special. In fact, the first three plagues, if you read the next few chapters closely, when God begins to bring plagues on Egypt as punishment for Pharaoh not responding, the first three plagues were done by the hand of Aaron. Aaron extends his staff over the Nile and it turns to blood. Aaron extends his staff over the Nile and frogs come up out of it. Aaron strikes the dust of the earth and it turns into gnats. It's Aaron's staff. The next two plagues, there is no agent. Moses doesn't do anything. Aaron doesn't do anything. God simply speaks. And the flies come and the livestock die. It's not until the sixth plague, five chapters and who knows how many weeks after chapter 4. In chapter 9, verses 8 through 10, that is when Moses' hand reappears. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Take handfuls of soot from the kiln, handfuls of soot, and let Moses throw them in the air in the sight of Pharaoh. It shall become fine dust over all the land of Egypt and become boils breaking out in sores on man and beast throughout all the land of Egypt." So they took soot from the kiln and stood before Pharaoh, and Moses threw it into the air. And you gotta wonder what he's thinking. Because if you take a handful of dust and throw it into the face in front of Pharaoh and nothing happens, that's gonna be pretty awkward. It is the tiniest yet biggest step of faith imaginable. Because it's not just a handful, the smallest bit you can have, just a handful of dust. It's a handful of used dust. Dust that's been burned in a furnace. You can't get much tinier than a wasted handful of dust. But that is the first action of Moses' hand. That is the first leap of faith of Moses' hand. What might your handful of dust be in response to God's call? The call to step up on a serve team at Cornerstone might simply be to say yes. The call to share your faith might simply be to strike up a conversation and say the name of God once. The handful of dust might be simply to ask your friend how you can pray for them. What might your handful of dust be? And those of you who have been down this pike often enough know that this call isn't a one-time thing. We have countless handful of dust moments throughout our lives. Even now, as I'm preparing to go out and become a pastor in upstate New York, a lot of times people have been asking me, whoa, do you realize what you're getting yourself into? More often, I'm starting to ask the question, do they realize what they're getting themselves into by hiring me? I mean, yeah, they saw my resume and they saw me preach, but they didn't see me eating a cardboard box at 3 a.m. with a bunch of teenagers the other night. Me? A pastor? Are they sure? Is this a good idea? But what's in your hand, Steve? A love to preach, a love for people, and hopefully next month a degree if everything goes well with this last paper. What's in your hand? Might just be a handful, seemingly, of dust. But do you know what God did with this handful of dust? The dust turned into boils on the Egyptian people. It served as a confirmation that what God said came true. It served as a symbol that God could work powerfully through Moses' hand. And you know what happened with Moses' hands after this passage? They just don't stop. The seventh plague, Moses extends his hand to heaven and hailstorms come down. The eighth plague, Moses extends his hand and locusts cover the earth. The ninth plague, Moses extends his hand and darkness covers the earth. The parting of the Red Sea, Moses extends his, actually his staff, but it's in his hand, so it still counts. And the Red Sea parts. The battle with the Amalekites, the longer Moses keeps his hands in the air, that is what makes the Israelites win the battle. Those hands go on to incredible things. And they started with a little handful of wasted dust. But don't miss the point of the story. It's that it had nothing to do with Moses' hands. God didn't need to use Moses. The first three plagues demonstrate he could have used Aaron. The next two plagues demonstrate he didn't need anybody. But he chose to use Moses so that by God's mighty hand, Moses' hands could have a part in God's work. Isn't that the same for us today? God doesn't call us to make disciples because he needs us to make disciples. Jesus would have been a far better pastor than me or Ryan. Hope you're not offended by that. It's probably true, though. Jesus could have done it without us. He could have done it without his disciples, but he wanted them to be a part of his work. It's like a mother who has her child help her bake a cake. They throw in a handful of sugar, stir it twice, and get bored and go back to coloring. And the mother throws the cake in the oven, takes it out, and says, "Look at the cake you made." She could have done it without him. But it was by his help that the cake was created. God doesn't have us be a part of his work because he needs us. He doesn't call us because he couldn't do it without us. He calls us because he doesn't want to do it without us. He calls us because that's his plan A. There is no backup plan. The beauty of the cross is that on the one hand, God's grace frees us from needing to do any good deeds. Jesus' death on the cross means we don't need to do good deeds to get to heaven. Yes, we're called to make disciples, but the amount of disciples we make has no bearing on whether we go to heaven or not. That is 100% paid for by Jesus' death on the cross. But the beauty of his resurrection is that now, by his Holy Spirit living in us, we have the power to do the good deeds we were made to do. His grace frees us from ever having to do it, and his grace equips us to do what we were made to do. It's not because he needs us, but it's because by participating in his work, we can live the way we were made to live. What's in your hand? I'll end with a story. Story of a boy named Austin who just loved to play basketball, but learned of the AIDS epidemic and of the devastation it wreaked and thought, isn't there something I can do? He came up with the idea of having friends and family sponsor him shooting free throws. And he shot a couple thousand free throws and raised a couple thousand dollars. Years later, Hoops for Hope is now an international 25-country, $4 million nonprofit. What's in your hand? It's just a basketball. What's in your hand? Time, finances, energy, a story? And what could it look like to throw it at the feet of God and let his grace do its work? Because if God can change the world with a handful of dust, he can change it with whatever is in your hand. Because when God calls and we yield, he works. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Stephen. Well, as we know, it is our practice here at Cornerstone on the first Sunday of every month to observe the Lord's Supper together. During this time of taking communion with one another, we are grateful that this great God stretched out his hand to save sinners like us, that even in the midst of our weakness and our failures and our great sin against him, we remember as we come to this table that we have a perfect high priest in Jesus Christ who lived perfectly for us, who died in our place, who rose from the grave. He is our Savior. And now, even now, he's welcoming us to come confidently to his throne for grace and help in time of need in this life. And he's also set us free from our sin unto eternal salvation. And so, Christians, we are coming to the table together to remember that Jesus has united us to himself and he's united us to one another as one in his body. We are coming to the table and we are remembering his great promises to us. That he is not only our strength in life, he is our hope in death. We're coming to this table and taking these elements, and we're remembering that just like bread and juice nourishes our physical bodies, only Jesus himself nourishes our souls. We're remembering that Jesus is with us even now, and he has promised to come again and to call us home. And so this act, it represents the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. This act reminds us that God is holy. He is our creator and our king, and he requires holiness, and he will not stand the presence of sin. And this act reminds us that we are sinful by nature. We are thoroughly depraved, and that our sin separates us from this holy God. Our sin lines us up as his enemies. Our sin means that we justly deserve his wrath. And there's nothing whatsoever that we can do to earn our salvation, to change that status before him. Coming to this table, it reminds us that in light of that bad news, there is good news. that the holy God in all his love for us sent his only son Jesus to live the perfect holy life that we couldn't live, to die in our place, to pay the penalty for our sins, to absorb the wrath of God that we deserve, to die, to be buried in a tomb, to be raised from the grave, to conquer Satan, sin, and death for us, so that when sinners like us turn to him and repent of our sin, and we turn to him in faith and we trust that Jesus and everything he did is totally sufficient to save us, this holy God is faithful to forgive us, to wash us clean, to adopt us into his family, to secure our eternity forever. That is what we're proclaiming when we come to this table. This represents the gospel. And so in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we are told to examine ourselves before we come to the table, because this is a important moment for us as a church family. This is a time for those who are truly regenerate Christians, for those who have been born again through faith in Jesus alone, by grace alone, and for those Christians who have dealt with their sin, brought their sin to the Lord in confession. And so before we come to the table as a family, we're going to spend a few moments preparing our hearts to worship him through taking communion together. And so I'd like to invite you, take a moment, bow your head, close your eyes, bow your heart, fix your attention, your affection on God himself. Let me lead you through a time of prayer as you prepare for communion.